From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Saunders is a renowned short story writer, known for his empathy for lost and despairing characters. But his debut novel is no different. It takes on grief, longing, and how we let go of people we love, how we let go of life itself. Saunders confronts these questions through a historical tragedy, the death of Abraham Lincoln's young son, Willie, and the rumor that Lincoln went back to the tomb to hold Willie's body. This hour on Point, George Saunders' new novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you dived into Lincoln in the Bardo? And what do you know about grief and letting go when life ends? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. This time, of course, is richly documented in historical documents. Among them has come down from Elizabeth Keckley, spent 30 years in slavery and became a dressmaker and confidant to First Lady Mary Todd Lincoln during those years in the White House. She wrote about her experiences in an 1868 autobiography. And before I bring George Saunders in, I want to just give a sense of that. Here's a passage read from the autobiography of a former slave who was there in the White House when Willie Lincoln, 11 years old, died in 1862. Here's Elizabeth Keckley, read by Ashley Jane for LibriVox, describing the moment when the President, Abraham Lincoln, walked into the room after his son Willie passed away.
He came to the bed, lifted the cover from the face of his child, gazed at it long and earnestly, murmuring, "My poor boy. He was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know that he is much better off in heaven, but then we loved him so. 'Tis hard, hard to have him die." Great sobs choked his utterance. He buried his head in his hands, and his tall frame was convulsed with emotion. I stood at the foot of the bed, my eyes full of tears, looking at the man in silent, awe-stricken wonder. His grief unnerved him, and made him a weak, passive child. I did not dream that his rugged nature could be so moved. I shall never forget those solemn moments.
From the historical record, Elizabeth Keckley's description of President Abraham Lincoln as he began to acknowledge the reality of the death of his son. But that is a complicated process. George Saunders writes about it. He joins us now from New York, author of acclaimed short stories, novellas, essays, MacArthur Genius Fellow, winner of the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story, creative writing professor at Syracuse University. His new novel, his first, is Lincoln in the Bardo. Colson Whitehead calls it a luminous feat of generosity and humanism. You can link to it at our website, an excerpt, onpointradio.org. George Saunders, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
We've been hearing about this. We've been reading. What first caught your attention in this story of Abraham Lincoln and the loss of his and Mary Todd Lincoln's, the loss of their son?
It was really just about 20 years ago hearing that story, you know, that he had lost his son while he was in the White House, and especially that haunting detail that he was rumored to have gone into the crypt on several occasions. That kind of, you know, got in my head and stayed there for 20 years.
Remind us of this historical moment, February 1862. This is well after eight months after the Battle of Bull Run, well before the Battle of Shiloh and a whole lot more. But where did the country stand in the progress of the war?
Well, I think we were just in the process of realizing that it was going to be more than just a little symbolic series of skirmishes, that thousands of people were going to die. Also, there was a real sense that Lincoln was screwing it up. You know, he was kind of a newcomer, and at that time, he was sort of filling the White House with visitors. They were coming to petition for him, and he was spending a lot of his days servicing them. And there was a lot of corruption in the government. So it was kind of a real muck-up. You know, things were getting worse. His reputation was terrible, taking a lot of heat in the press. And so at this moment, his sons, they both get sick. And they've got a big party scheduled at the White House. And, you know, it was such a kind of familiar parental dilemma. Do we cancel this big party that's been in preparation for a month, or do we just sort of go ahead? And the doctor advised that they go ahead and have the party. And so they have hundreds of people in the White House, big noise, big excitement. Mm-hmm. And that was the night on which Willie's health took a turn for the worse. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, he passed away.
Willie and Tad, both sick. Do we know exactly what they were sick with?
I think the idea now is typhoid, but what's interesting is when you, go through the historical record, and there was a lot of confusion about it even at the time. So I think Lincoln, in his lifetime, never would have really known what killed him. There were some thoughts that he had been out riding a horse in the rain, and other thoughts that they'd gone over to play near a veterans hospital where there would have been lots of disease, some thoughts about contaminated water. But I think now people think it was typhoid.
You began the book with a lot of this captivating melange of a lot of quoting of bits and excerpts and pieces of documents from historians and the historical record, mixed in with some of your own sort of posing as such, but to fill it up. But some of these are absolutely historical, and they're talking about this party, dining room. This is Cunard and Cunard with a long table, gigantic looking glass upon it with the massive confections of sugar. Sort of icing versions of Fort Sumter and a warship and a Temple of Liberty and a Chinese pagoda and a Swiss cottage. And they're talking here about dining on tender pheasant and fat partridge and venison steaks and Virginia hams and slurped raw, I don't know, oysters and whatever, scalloped and
whatever they could get hold of.
They could get. And meanwhile, the Lincolns know that their son is very ill upstairs, and you describe them, one of these describes as mechanically smiling hostess and her husband that kept climbing the stairs to see how Willie was, and he was not doing well at all. Were they at all prepared in your reading for his death?
I don't think so. Of course, at that time, child mortality was a little more common than it is now. And they had lost a baby before.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were prepared for this. They both took it really hard. And I think, my sense is that neither one of them, Mary or Abe, ever really got over it. In fact, one of the really sad things is one of the last conversations that we know that Lincoln had was with Mary, I think on the day of his assassination, maybe a day before. And basically he said, we haven't been right since Willie's death, and we're going to have to get over it. And now that the war is over, maybe we can concentrate on getting back to our happy selves. So I think it was a big one. And he was described as kind of the favorite son and the one that I think they had the highest hopes for and so on.
This president's a remarkable figure to carry some of the work of your work here. I mean, because we think of him as a man of such great emotional depth. And yet, the way you describe his sorrow, the way you bring it to us, you actually describe him going to the tomb and opening the coffin and bringing out the body of his son in your telling on the night after the internment there, if that's what you call it, entombment, I guess. Did that happen, or that was simply a rumor?
Well, it was a rumor that was reported in the newspapers, and depending on where you find it, it's that he went into the crypt, that he looked upon the body, that he picked up the body. So that was maybe one of the things that intrigued me was, one, we can't know. There's no way we could trace it back. Two, it seems strange that it would be reported. I mean, it's a weird thing for somebody to make up. It also kind of fits with some other things we know about Lincoln, also rumors, but that, for example, when his first love died, he spent the night at her tomb, a rainy night. Mm. So I don't really know. But, in terms of a novel is probably best located on what should have happened. So in other words, is it kind of cool to think that it might have? Yeah, it kind of is. For the writer, does that feel like an interesting doorway to go through? Not so much to examine Lincoln in some historical context, but to kind of use him as a vehicle to think about the kind of deeper questions. My sense after all this is done is that some version of it did happen, but I have no way of really knowing.
It leaves us with this sort of pietà image of the president in his deepest grief with the body of his son in his arms, whether or not it happened. For fiction, it takes us somewhere very fertile. Lincoln and the Bardo. What's Bardo?
Well, Bardo is a Tibetan term that means transitional state. So technically we're in a Bardo now, the one that goes the transition between birth and death. The Bardo I'm referring to in the book is the one that starts, really right at the moment of your death and goes to whatever comes next. So in the Tibetan tradition, it would be reincarnation. But in my sense, it was sort of that his son was in that state, kind of. He'd passed away. His spirit was separate from his body, but he's sort of lovingly still connected to his familial life, and he can't quite move on. But also, Abraham Lincoln is in that transition of grief, you know, that he's somehow has to put this behind him in some way so he can, you know, get onto this huge work at which he's failing. So I kind of, you know, early on, my sense of the structure was that both of these Lincolns was trying to get on to something that they sort of knew they had to do, but they weren't quite ready to go there yet.
But acceptance of death, I mean, you're talking about the Civil War as a huge work. Acceptance of death, no matter how high or small the station of a human being, also a huge work.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the work. You know, it's funny to have be working on this book for 4 years, and every day you had an occasion to go into your office and kind of play around with the idea of death. But I don't think I'm any more ready for it than I was. But I do think it's kind of, you know, over the process, I realize it's a fairly healthy thing to think about it every now and then, maybe even every day, to just go, yeah, this is the game we're in. You know, it's a beautiful life full of so much joy, but everything is conditional. And everything comes to an end. So just to kind of turn your mind in that direction every now and then, that's about as far as I can go with it.
George Saunders is author of the new novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, and it takes characters, historical figures that we know well, Abraham Lincoln, his young son Willie, Mary Todd Lincoln, takes them to that moment where they must confront the death of a loved one, where the child himself, or the human who has died, must confront that, looks at it through a Tibetan Buddhist lens. Lincoln in the Bardo is the book. You can join us. Do you know this terrain? Have you been there? Have you walked that borderland between life and death with a loved one and struggled to let go? Remembering Willie here from John Williams from the Steven Spielberg 2012 biopic, Lincoln. George Saunders, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this out about the real-life death of Abraham Lincoln's young son, Willie, reimagined in fiction as a meditation on grief and moving on, acceptance. George Saunders is my guest. His new novel, his first novel, though an acclaimed short story writer for a long time now, is titled Lincoln in the Bardo. It's a bestseller, getting great reviews. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Describes Abraham Lincoln and the population, he'll tell us about that, of the cemetery where his young son was laid. Here's a little bit more from the movie Lincoln. This is Daniel Day-Lewis playing Abraham Lincoln in an argument with his wife, Mary Todd, conveying the grief that inspired George Saunders' Lincoln in the Bardo.
I couldn't tolerate you grieving so for Willie because I couldn't permit it in myself, though I wanted to, Mary. I wanted to crawl under the earth, into the vault, with his coffin. And I still do. Every day I do.
In George Saunders' book, in a way, he does. And here's a scene from Ken Burns' acclaimed 1990 documentary, The Civil War, actress reading the actual words of Mary Todd Lincoln describing her feelings after the death of 11-year-old Willie, their son.
If I had not felt the spur of necessity urging me to cheer Mr. Lincoln, whose grief was as great as my own, I could never have smiled again.
So, George, would you be good enough to paint the picture for us of the cemetery and the inhabitants that you imagine there greeting young, now dead, but not fully moved on to death, Willie Lincoln and his father?
Yeah, well, one of the technical challenges of the book was to make it, you know, as much about life as death, to make it lively, to make it sort of full of the things of the world and kind of the sense that, you know, one of the reasons death hurts so much is that we love life so well. It's so dear to us. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just stumbled on the idea that, you know, if you think about Lincoln going into a graveyard at night, who's there? Well, you know, it could be Lincoln himself narrating what seemed like a lot of work and kind of familiar territory. Mm-hmm. Could be, you know, a grave digger, but no reason he would be there that late. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, you know, maybe there's a sort of ghostly Greek chorus of other people who have died and not quite been able to accept it. And so they're kind of lingering around, some of them for 10, 20 years even, mm-hmm. Kind of willing themselves to stay And one of the ways they do this is they, well, first they deny that they're dead. They don't know it, or they pretend not to know it. Mm-hmm. And second of all, they just do this thing that I guess actually living people do too, which is to kind of continually reestablish their identities by telling the same stories over and over again. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of telling to themselves who they are, why they're different from everyone else in the graveyard. So the main three are a former printer who died just before he consummated his marriage, a young gay guy who was sort of had his heart broken and committed suicide, and then a reverend who died sort of naturally and then actually is the one of these ghosts who's kind of been the closest to the actual judgment day. So these three are kind of they become friends over the years, and they're kind of frozen in a pattern of kind of slothful selfishness, really. They're just basically spend all their nights just trying to stay, basically, and not go on to the next thing. And then into this, there suddenly comes this young boy, and he kind of re-energizes them in a certain way.
What if you, well, read a little bit for us. We should set the scene. In your telling, Willie is entombed in sort of a grand catacomb, I guess, a borrowed place there. It may not be his last resting place. And in fact, it wasn't. His body eventually went back to Illinois with his father after Lincoln's assassination years later. But and, of course, that all takes place. And then that night, in your reimagination of this, a very tall man on a rather small horse shows up at the gate and comes into the cemetery. This is Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown, not still there, and makes his way into back through the cemetery as these Greek courses, as you say, of spirits watch on and comment. And you tell it sort of through their comments. And I wonder if you might read as he comes in and actually goes into the crypt and lifts the body of his son?
Sure. And what we're going to hear, there's actually three different people speaking, mm-hmm. and in the book they're attributed after the quotes, but I'll omit those and just read the sort of voices. The unkempt gentleman was fussing over the small form now, stroking the hair, patting and rearranging the pale, doll-like hands. As the lad stood nearby, uttering many urgent entreaties for his father to look his way, fuss over and pat him, which the gentleman appeared not to hear. Then this already troubling and unseemly display descended to a new level of... We heard an intake of breath from the reverend, who, appearance notwithstanding, is not easily shocked. "He is going to pick that child up," the reverend said. And so he did. The man lifted the tiny form out of the sick box. The man bent, lifted the tiny form from the box, and with surprising grace for one so ill-made, sat all at once on the floor, gathering it into his lap. Sinking his head into the place between chin and neck, the gentleman sobbed, raggedly at first, then unreservedly, giving full vent to his emotions, while the lad darted back and forth nearby in an apparent agony of frustration.
George Saunders, reading from his novel Lincoln in the Bardo. This is a powerful scene. Abraham Lincoln, there in the crypt, lifting the body out of what they call the sick box, these spirits looking on, because they're not accepting death. This is a coffin. And the boy darting around, that would be, George, the spirit of the boy, is watching his father lift the body.
That's right. Yeah, there's the body, and then there's the boy who's separate from it. And the boy actually, he's sort of, in the Tibetan tradition, they say that once your spirit leaves the body is often very repulsive to you. So in this case, the boy, he sees this kind of worm-like thing wearing his suit, and it's really
his
confusing
remains
to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his remains, right.
And he wants his father to acknowledge him, but his father is focused on these physical remains. In terms of the process that you describe, of both the living and the dead coming to terms with death, at this moment when the president lifts the lid of his son's coffin and gently raises the body out to hold it in his lap and the spirit of his son then sort of darting around, where are they in that process here, George?
Well, when you're approaching something like this, you're kind of hoping for some central question to lead you. And so for me, that was always this. I'm willing to believe that Lincoln came into the crypt, and I know why, I think. You love somebody, and although you know that the body is not the person, it's it would be easy to make that mistake. You're, mm-hmm. of course, fond of the physical form, and that's what you've known mm-hmm. your whole life. So I get that part. The thing that was intriguing to me was, why would he leave? In other words, the accounts I heard said he had done this on several occasions. Mm-hmm. So the question was, what's that process like where you come once, you maybe mm-hmm. touch or look at the body, you get some satisfaction from that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you do it a second time. At some point, it wears thin. And that seemed to me like a very fraught, kind of beautiful, maybe even slightly morbid moment where mm-hmm. you start to make that distinction that whatever it is that we love when we love somebody is some magical, very fleeting combination of mind and body. And once that gets severed, you just, you know, you try as you might, you can't reconstruct that thing.
But he's working through that with his one visit or his multiple visits. And the process is coming to the point where I suppose the president feels, okay, enough. The grief isn't gone, but somehow he's come to terms with some part of this.
Yes, whatever I'm doing here, it's not profiting me any. And, you know, Lincoln was such a logical, syllogistic kind of thinker and so bold about following the logic. If the logic told him X was true, he would go there. So I think part of what happens over the course of the book is he sees that this is a dead end for him and that any energy he puts into this is being stolen from somewhere else. And so, much against his will and very unhappily, he kind of decides that it's time to go.
Have you had to deal with this kind of loss in your own life? I have, sadly. Mm. Have
I'm
you?
I'm sorry. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago I would have said no, and then I remembered something. You know, when you talk about a book at length, you sometimes kind of peel back layers. And I remember that when I was in college, a very, very dear cousin of mine named Debbie Wansley was killed in a car accident. She was quite young. And that was a shocker. I think before that time, I guess like a lot of people, I thought death always comes late in life and there's some sense of closure and peace and so on. Or maybe it's some stranger, deeper level. I thought, well, love or death doesn't come to you if you're good or somehow, mm-hmm. you know, if you're living correctly. This idea that death is sort of
untimely death.
Exactly, yes. So this was kind of a shocker, and I think I never really quite, you know, made sense of it, and it certainly changed the way I thought about life. It made me feel always much more vulnerable, and that whatever untimely death was, it wasn't in consequence for something. It could just drop on you at any time, and that really changes your relation mm-hmm. to the world. You know, even if you were a religious person and you believe in a benevolent creator, the possibility of that kind of sudden blow is, I think, always somewhere in your mind.
Mm-hmm. I had a young brother who died very young, and I watched my parents go through that. I was older and watched them with that. I remember that his very small coffin and people gazing on it and the work, I guess, that they were doing spiritually, certainly psychologically, as they did. Got a lot of response for you. George Saunders is with us. Yeah. His new novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. And Susan writes to us. She says, thank you for your interview with author George Saunders. She says, I picked up the book recently because I heard that it was great, but also because I lost a child myself. He died 5 years ago, and the pain is as fresh as when he passed. I identified with the difficulty in moving on. There were times that I wished that I could open my son's grave and hold him one last time. Loss is the same for any parent, no matter your station in life or what period in time they've lived. Jason's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air with George Saunders.
Hello. Well, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Jason.
I want to tell you a brief story. I'm a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism and have been for many, many years. And I've spent 60 years actually dealing with the circumstances, feelings, and so on about my father's difficult death, I heard from my mom that he was very ill. I got on a plane, got to California as fast as I could, and during those 3 days, his wife kept telling him that I was coming, and even though he was on life support, it seemed as though he kind of hung on in some way until I got there, and I did traditional Tibetan prayers sources, very old sources mm-hmm. and stuff. And in that kind of gray light before dawn, before sun up, I kind of got a message from her, a signal to just stop doing things and just be quiet and be with him. And I just felt like my spirit and his were present. And even though his body wasn't animated and they had taken him off life support by then, but the process of leaving happened in stages. First the body and then the heat of the body. And then I could kind of get a sense when his spirit left. And it was just what it was. I've had a lot of regret, and the difficulty for me in letting go is that I've understood in years past that he probably died by a medical error. And it was by the time that became possible to my thinking and understanding, it was really too late to dig up records or get an attorney or anything. But I'm left with that moment with him.
Jason, a fellow Tibetan Buddhist here. George, you are a practicing Buddhist yourself?
I'm a kind of an amateur, yeah, definitely a beginner, but yeah, it's a beautiful tradition. And, you know, Jason, that makes me think, you know, that one of the kind of strange pleasures of this book was, you know, you hear about it in outline and it sounds kind of sad and morbid, which, of course, it's definitely sad. But I love this idea that, you know, whatever death is, we don't know what it is. These spiritual traditions help us, I think, get in relation to it in some way. But to me, it came to be kind of almost a thrilling proposition that, one, this is definitely going to happen to me. And still, life is gorgeous, and I love being in it. So is there some way to actually, you know, use the awareness of death and that terrible parting as a way to actually make life even more lovely? And I think the answer has to be yes. You know, in other words, if we think of death as something that shouldn't happen, that's unnatural or that's some kind of, you know, misfortune, then I think it's always terrifying. But I in some of these texts, I've gotten the sense that it's very realistic, almost scientific, to take death duly into account as just part of the bargain. You know, this is part of the bargain. When we see the beauty, it's because it's temporary.
Jason, I very much appreciate your call. As beautiful as that may be, accepting it when it comes especially untimely is hard. In Tibetan Buddhism, what's the work for the living and for the dead, as you describe it, that's involved in moving beyond the bardo, the sort of limbo?
Well, I should say that the bardo that I make in this book has only a faint resemblance to the bardo represented in Tibetan text. That, if you know, it would be irresponsible to say otherwise. Mm-hmm. For me, the main thing is something like this. The idea that whatever happens to us at the moment of death or just before and after would probably be causally related to the way our minds are working right now. It would be very strange if suddenly, you know, you weren't you anymore. So that's both, you know, to me it's terrifying and it's hopeful. It means that if you could work with your mind right now, it might somehow ease the transition. Mm-hmm. That seems to me kind of interesting. And it makes me think of this line from the Gnostic Gospels that says, if you bring forth that which is within you, what is within you will save you. If you do not bring forth that which is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And that seems to me basically true wherever we are, you know, that there's any hint of denial or the sort of repression of the truth is going to be costly. It's costly now. It's costly right this minute.
This On Point podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real-life death of Abraham Lincoln's young son, Willie, reimagined in fiction as a meditation on grief and moving on, acceptance for the living and the dead in the telling of George Saunders. It's his first novel, acclaimed short story writer, but he's come to the novel with Lincoln in the Bardo. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us from New York, and you can join us this hour. Have you contemplated your mortality? Do you think you are in some way ready to accept the inevitable when it comes? Can fiction help us prepare, visualize the challenge, cross over? Abraham Lincoln, as president, 1862, in George's telling, comes to the cemetery, middle of the night, opens the crypt, opens the coffin, holds the body of his young son in his arms, and there's a kind of Greek chorus of other spirits in the cemetery, those who have not even acknowledged their death and have not accepted it and not moved on. It is the most somber and difficult thing. It's also, as you say, George, can be kind of funny. Sleepless writes to us, Now I'm going to think I'm dead for 10 years and have to talk it out with my therapist. Thanks, On Point. Am I dead? Okay. All right. Let's go to Lincoln Country. Lincoln, Illinois. Robert is calling. Hi, Robert. You're on the air with George Saunders. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for the topic.
Mm-hmm.
I am a chaplain in the land of Lincoln area. In fact, I live in Lincoln, but I grew up in that reference you had earlier about Spoon River Anthologies. I grew up in that area. Canton, Fulton County.
Yep.
It's the great equalizer, you know, that I've seen in my work with folks almost every day who are grieving, rich or poor, those with great political power, those with none. And I really like the emphasis as we talk about Lincoln, as I live in the only town in the nation named for and christened by Abraham Lincoln before his rise to national prominence. It really helps you understand, hey, I can understand Lincoln. Of all the things and of all the ways that we see Lincoln who's held in such high esteem, especially in Lincoln, Illinois, this is one of those areas that you can really, truly see I'm with him. I understand the feelings that he's wrestling with.
In that the experience of death is universal and all of us sometime or other have to confront it, Robert, you mean?
Yes, and in the grief, mm-hmm. you know, and in that working out spiritually with your grief and doing the hard work of a lot of sorrow and a lot of anguish and living with those things, not running away, and being able to live with that helplessness.
Yes.
And still live a life that has great meaning and purpose. I won't be president, but I can touch lives, and I can be there with others in making a difference, just like Abraham Lincoln did.
Yeah. Robert, thank you so much for your call. A chaplain who's seen the great equalizer and how people deal with it. I appreciate your call from Lincoln. I mean, George, using Lincoln in this book, I mean, we think of him as having such a capacious soul. It's kind of a magnifying glass for whatever you put in front of him, especially the profound.
Yeah.
You really work with that here.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I love what Robert said about sorrow and how, you know, what I felt working with this material was that Lincoln was so beat down by this sorrow and by the war and by everything that, in a sense, you know, whatever reserves of sort of happiness or kind of, you know, sometimes what we do in life, I think, is we kind of go on autopilot by telling ourselves a positive narrative about ourselves. You know, I'm a good father, I'm a good husband, I'm a mm-hmm. good president. Mm-hmm. Those near to me will be with me forever. I think all those things got stripped away from Lincoln in about a 2-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually, I think that's maybe part of the reason we love him is that led him to this, I'm imagining, a really scary place of wisdom where all of your usual go-tos are denied you. The simple pleasures of life aren't there anymore. You've absorbed this crazy loss. You're in the middle of a war that is kind of your doing mm-hmm. that is going off the rails and is costing
and
tens
so
of thousands
dying.
Of people
mm-hmm.
to feel that grief. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So part of what I intuited was that that might make a person, well, it might make him insane, but in Lincoln's case, I think it's why we consider him so wise, with no sort of pretense of control. Does that take us to a place of real clear seeing? I know in times when I've lost somebody, there is that 2 or 3 day period of real frightening kind of wonderful clarity about what this life actually is. Mm-hmm. You know, all of your usual defenses have been taken away. I've found that very hard to sustain, and I think that's probably Darwinian, that, you know, we can't stay in that state very long. But I think Lincoln got there and stayed there for quite a long time. And in those last 3 or 4 years of his life, it seems to me he made incredible spiritual strides that a normal person under normal conditions would have been hard put to make.
Clarity, but also such a storm to come out of that with greater spiritual clarity is a gift and accomplishment. Winterville, North Carolina. Carl, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I found the subject extremely interesting. I recently lost my wife of 43 years, and the grief I find is overwhelming at times. It is one of the most uncontrollable feelings, I think, that a person will ever go through. I've tried some meditation. I've been into some Buddhist meditation. But I think the loss of control and the realization that that person is never coming back is the hardest thing to accept.
Hmm. You know, Carl, the same thing happened to me just a couple of years back. And after about the same length of time with a lost love, I found it. I mean, I wasn't sure I wanted to live for a while there, Carl.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been about 3.5, 4 months now. And at first, you're very busy with the things that you need to do. You know, you have insurance, you have changing over bank accounts, and it kind of takes your mind off it. But I'm at the point now where, yes, I do question if it's worth going on. I've been with my wife since I was 16 years old.
Yeah, me too.
We were together 45 years, mm-hmm. and it's I do not know how to live this life that I'm living now.
For what it's worth.
Even though I have children and grandchildren, it could never take the place of the spouse, the companionship.
Yeah. For what it's worth, Carla, I was right there, and it was unspeakable and seemed like it would never pass. And when people told me that it would, I felt even a kind of anger that, you know, they were sort of denying the depth of grief I was feeling. And somehow with some work, it did get better over time for me anyway. I pray and almost expect it will for you too, but I appreciate your call. George, take us back to the work here, the work for the living and the dead, and what through your characters were sometimes full of humor or foibles. What do we learn about what's required to work through even this?
Yeah, well, first let me just say, Carl, I'm so sorry for your loss. And you know, I think one of the things about fiction is that you're really not in the solving business. Like Chekhov said, you know, art doesn't have to solve problems. Mm-hmm. It just has to formulate them correctly. So part of that idea is that if you formulate a problem like this correctly, mm-hmm. It might actually make it a little harder. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you express it hopefully in a correct way. It's the equivalent of turning, you know, your own head to, you know, so that your eyes face the problem directly and you're not allowed to look away. My takeaway from having written this book for 4 years is that I'm not ready. I don't know the answers. But it's urgent, you know. It feels much more urgent that I somehow get in relation to those things. But I think often art is, you know, at its best, it actually doesn't let us off the hook. It puts us on the hook more firmly. But like a mm-hmm. good friend who calls you out, mm-hmm. it's kind of valuable.
See the fullness of this reality. But you do depict these spirits who haven't made it beyond the limbo, the bardo. And so you've thought about some of the characteristics of their souls that made it more difficult for them to move on.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that came to me through the book was this idea that we, of course, we conceptualize ourselves as being separate from everybody else. And we understand ourselves, you know, from the moment we're conscious, we understand ourselves to be separate and somehow, you know, a little better or, a little mm-hmm. more important. Mm-hmm. We're the star of the show. I think that leads to a lot of problems. In other words, when I think about leaving this earth, it bothers me that it's me leaving this earth. You know, I have a real strong clinging to this guy, George, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally natural. But on the other hand, if you were a Martian and you look down, you say, well, that baby was born and immediately started changing like crazy. And based on everything else I see, that baby named George is going to end up dead like the rest of them. Doesn't make sense for that guy to be so fond of himself. So I think part of the various spiritual traditions is try to get over it yourself, to try to get over the idea of your own centrality and permanence. So that sounds pretty good. And I certainly have that idea in my head, but I don't have it in my body at all. So I think that's really the thing. You know, death is scary and traumatic in part because we don't understand what we're doing here. We don't understand who we are actually. And the great kind of strangeness of it is that we're built to not understand it. We're built to mm-hmm. see ourselves as separate entities. And then it really costs us when it's time to go out the door.
George, would you read one more bit from the book for us? This is a scene where angels are about to arrive at the cemetery to tempt these spirits to their final afterlives, and the spirits who are there in limbo, they know these angels, they see them as kind of tricksters sent to make them give up their ability to live again if they keep waiting in the bardos. But could you read a bit for us?
Yeah, these beings come every now and then, and they're sort of like almost like maintenance figures. They're trying to get these spirits to move on. And they present in different ways.
To
accept their state. So this is, again, these are some of these ghosts talking among themselves. Presently, we became aware by way of certain familiar signs that trouble was brewing. It happened as it always happens. A hush fell across the premises. The scraping of winter branches against winter branches could be heard. A warm breeze arose, fragrant with all manner of things that give comfort: grass, sun, beer, bread, quilts, cream, this list being different for each of us, each being differently comforted. Flowers of extraordinary color, size, shape, and fragrance sprang forth, fully formed, from the earth. The gray February trees began to blossom, then yielded fruit. Fruit responsive to one's wishing, only let the mind drift in the direction of a certain color, silver, say, and shape, star, and of the instant a bounty of star-shaped silver fruits would sag the limbs of a tree that seconds before had stood fruitless and winter dead. The paths between our mounds, the spaces beneath trees, the seats of the benches, the crooks and limbs of the trees themselves, in short, every available inch of space, became spontaneously filled, then overfilled, with food of every variety, in pots and upon fine plates, on spits run between boughs, in golden troughs, in diamond tureens, in tiny emerald sauce bowls. A wall of water rushed in from the north, then divided itself with military precision into dozens of sub-streams, such that each stone home and sick mound soon had its own dedicated tributary, the water in these tributaries then rather flamboyantly converting itself into coffee, wine, whiskey, and back into water again. All of these things we knew, the fruited trees, the sweet breeze, the endless food, the magical streams, comprised merely the advance guard, so to speak, of what was coming, of who was coming.
George Saunders reading from Lincoln in the Bardo. The spirits ready to resist accepting, ready to see the angels, if you will, as tricksters. Martina in Baltimore. Thank you for calling, Martina. You're on the air with George Saunders.
Thank you. I'm kind of calling in the opposite end of the last caller who mm-hmm. was with someone for so long. And I was just engaged, 21, when my fiancé was killed in Iraq. I was as well serving in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I only have that perspective to offer. Is at that moment you feel like you saw your whole life laid out in front of you, and that was the way that it was going to be, and then suddenly it's not. And you have to really confront the idea that, is it worth going on if that's not the life that's going to be offered to me anymore? That's the only life I thought I wanted. And I think conversations like this are just so important and valuable because it offers that perspective that you don't get when you're going through something like that. It, you know, to let people know that life, it's so different, but it's worth it. It's worth going on and seeing that I've fallen in love again, and it's different, but it's wonderful. And I just feel like this conversation is just so important for people who are currently going through something like this, and they do question, is it worth it?
Martina, I'm so glad to hear the end of that story, that you fall in love again. That's a beautiful, beautiful thing there. And I thank you for your call. Our time is so short, George. It's the living and the dead in your telling who must come to terms, must accept.
Yeah. And Martina, yes, I'm glad to hear that too. You know, I think one of the things that reading this book and getting to know a bit about that 19th century America, I think it's fair to say they were in a different relation to death than we are. And I think in some ways healthier. They saw it, they tended to it in their own homes. And there wasn't quite the sense of denial that we have now. And I think that denial makes it really hard to imagine a life beyond a death.
Well, the years you spent thinking through this and handling it and writing about it help us sort of hold it more supply and more with more awareness and maybe acceptance as well. That's a pretty big gift.
Well, I truly hope so.
Yeah. George, thank you very much for spending some time with us today. It was wonderful.
Thank you, Tom. Such a pleasure.
George Saunders, acclaimed short story writer, now novelist, Tibetan Buddhist, and author of the new novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.